This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday and time for The Wheelhouse, our roundtable about the news of the week, and there has been a lot of news. Coming up, a new report card says problems still linger at the State Department of Children and Families. Springfield residents get ready to vote on a casino plan and a lawsuit against the XL Center over disability rights. But we'll start with some more news coming out of the Newtown shootings back in December. Last week, we spoke with Andrew Julian on the program. He's editor of the Hartford Courant. His paper just completed two big stories about shooter Adam Lanza, stories that shed a bit more light on his childhood but fell far short of what we'd hoped to know. Of course, we've been waiting for months for an official report. It was originally scheduled to be released in June. Now, who knows how long it will actually take. Julian on the program addressed the criticism that the Courant has gotten over these stories and whether the continued coverage is insensitive.
There is a growing sentiment, I think, 6 months after Sandy Hook, that people want this to recede a little bit from frontline consciousness. I mean, for the last 6 months between the gun debates in the legislature and everything, the state has been living this day in and day out, and people want it to go quiet, and people are genuinely concerned about the families, and we are genuinely concerned about the families. But at the same time, we do think there are critical questions that still need to be answered. So we're going to use restraint. We're going to be careful about what we publish to make sure it's accurate and fair. But we have to do this.
Now, this week, the Connecticut Hearst newspapers entered back into this realm, publishing a big story about the Newtown police response. The story cites a source familiar with the state police investigation as saying that police in Newtown delayed entering the building while Adam Lanza fired some 10 shots. Some officers told the paper that they're worried that their actions are being second-guessed. You can join the conversation. What's your reaction to the latest news about the Newtown shootings? Do you think it's time for the state to release more information? 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266 or email wherewelive at WNPR.org. CTN, the Connecticut Network, is here as well today. Mark Pazniokas joins us. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Good to see you again, Paz.
Good to see you.
And Tom Baden is here. He's editor of the Danbury News-Times, one of the four Connecticut Hearst newspapers. Tom, welcome to our program.
Good morning.
So we're going to start there, and we're going to start with a story that you folks ran over the weekend. Maybe you can lay out a little bit about what you learned that's new in the investigation into the shootings.
Sure. What we were trying to do was take a look at the investigation in terms of the police response. In addition to trying to figure out what drove Adam Lanza to do what he did, the state police investigation is taking a look at the police response. And this is nothing unusual. After any type of mass shooting in the past, there's been an assessment of how the first responders came in, as well as other issues. And we learned a lot after Columbine. We learned a lot after the shooting in Manchester, some of the other mass shootings that have occurred in the last decade. What we were told, among other things, is that investigators are looking at the cruiser camera, video and audio, to try to ascertain the nature of the initial police response. And as part of that, realized that you could hear shots going off before police entered. Steven Sedensky, the state's attorney from Danbury, has told us that there were 154 rounds fired by Adam Lanza inside the school. 10 shots were heard before police went in. Now, is this significant? Is this relevant? Was there a good reason for a delay, if there was a delay? That's all something that's going to presumably come out in the investigation. And the Newtown police chief, Michael Kehoe, made that point, as did others, speaking to the chaos of that initial response. When police arrived there, there was a report of another gunman, potentially. There was confusion as to whether the officers were being shot at. So the reaction that I think has come from the community is that this may be understandable. Nonetheless, it's part of what a good investigation should look at, because you learn things from this police response. You learn whether your training was adequate, whether the equipment you had was appropriate, whether your tactics going into the building were appropriate. And those tactics have changed since Columbine. Back in 1999, when police responded to Columbine, the initial officers who showed up at the school secured the perimeter, and SWAT teams did not go in for another 40 minutes, during which time the gunmen roamed the building, setting off pipe bombs, shooting people at random. So authorities learned a lot about what should your initial response have been. And clearly there are different circumstances, different conditions, But I think that's part of the process that's going on right here.
In the second graph of this story, and this is John Pirro, the reporter, and I'm reading this out of the News Times website, and you can find it at newstimes.com. It says that this source that you're quoted says, there is no doubt there was some delay. The question is whether it was significant or justified.
Right.
And I think that that's really the main question for people is what we're essentially finding out is from a source. This is not the official investigation, but this is a source that you have found, much like the conversation we had with the Hartford Current last week, that is suggesting that there may be something wrong, or there may not be something wrong, but it's just an incremental piece of information. Talk about how you decide to play that in your newspaper, given the fact that we're moving things a little tiny bit here, but it's a little bit of information creeping out as we all wait for some official word here.
Sure. We tried to take great pains to put this information in context. The story was a 90-inch story and contained a lot of information about what we know, a lot of information about what we don't know, as well as a look at reports that have examined police response at other shootings. The reason we went with the story is we feel like we have an obligation to our readers to keep them up to date on the progress of the investigation. And we made no efforts to portray this as in any way definitive and dispositive. In terms of using information from an unnamed source, we generally use three criteria. Is it critical to the story? Does it come from a credible source? And is there any other way we can get the information? So we felt that the parameters that we use were met in this instance.
You know, after we had Andrew Julian on the program last week, Mark Pazniokas, the Hartford Current actually did an editorial piece saying that one way to stop the leaks, as state police investigators have been calling them, people close to the investigation, talking to papers like Tom's, papers like Andrew's, is to actually get all this information out there. We've been waiting for months and months and months. Originally, this was supposed to come back in June. It still hasn't come. What are you hearing, if anything at all, from people at the Capitol about when we're going to know more so that we're not getting information from unnamed sources in newspapers over the course of the next few months?
I haven't heard anything at the Capitol recently. Since the legislature put this issue to bed, the legislative interest in this, you know, it has waned to a great degree, and it shifted to other legislative business. But, you know, one of the things that struck me over the weekend with the air disaster in San Francisco is how quickly my favorite federal agency, the NTSB, came out with hard information. I covered an incident at Bradley years ago, and I dealt firsthand with these guys. And they are very matter of fact. As the information comes in, they share it. They say, this is not the final conclusion, even in the case of San Francisco, where it appears the pilot really screwed up. But they're saying, well, this is our information so far. And over the course of my career in dealing with police, I often think of how the NTSB handles the dispersal of information, and if law enforcement could do a little bit more of that. And I understand there are times there are very good reasons, but in this case, this is not a whodunit. The perpetrator is dead, so this is really an exhaustive review of what happened. What do we know about what led to it? How did the police respond? And, it really, I think, would have benefited everybody if Sendensky had come out with some interim reports. And I think it would have tamped down some of the speculation that certainly we've seen on the internet.
Well, and we actually just heard this morning. The NTSB was responding to an airline's pilot coalition, essentially saying that you're giving out way too much information. Right. It's fueling speculation. But essentially, NTSB says, Tom, when we got information, we're going to give it out. It seems as though, indeed, we would be reporting this differently if that was coming from law enforcement.
I agree. The state police have insisted that they do not want incorrect information to go out, hence their caution on this. I should also point out that it's pretty clear that Adam Lanza wanted to erase any tracks and went to great lengths to destroy computer hard drives. There aren't a lot of footprints to this guy, so it has been difficult. But I absolutely agree with Mark. There's been so much speculation and scuttlebutt about this that I think it would have it would have been useful and helpful to the community if there had been some sort of interim report saying this is what we know, this is what we're still trying to find out.
I want to go to Kathy in Durham. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Kathy, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very pleased to hear what the current editor said about tying this in with the air disaster in San Francisco. I mean, whenever there's an air disaster, there's an entire organization, the FAA, that descends upon it and looks at every aspect in an objective way and takes their time. And yes, they do release information piecemeal, and, you know, people will take that and do what they want with it. But eventually there is a unified report that looks at everything and makes a final consensus opinion. And then they take that and they try to prevent it from happening. And they have succeeded greatly. In spite of this accident, there were not any other accidents in several years in this country in air travel. And if we did that, they allowed that to happen. And so we can't suppress the information, but they did it with the 9/11 Commission. And if the 30,000 people die every year from guns in this country, if they actually took every gun death as seriously as they do any death by accident, maybe we would get somewhere with public's understanding of how guns are terrible. And you know, but the public wants to sweep it under the rug. And I'm sorry for the Sandy Hook victims, but this has to come out so we can prevent it from happening again. And that's my my comment. Thank you.
Well, and Kathy, thank you very much. And Mark Pasniokas from the Connecticut Mirror had been talking about that before. I think one of the big differences, though, just to be clear, is there are very few, thank God, major airline disasters in America, and fewer all the time, as Kathy suggests, because we learn an awful lot from each one. But that is a centralized system. When there's a shooting like this, the first responders are small-town policemen in Newtown. It's sometimes in Chicago, it's big city policemen. It's different every single place. There's not one standard way that you can do an investigation to get information out.
No, but this is the extraordinary case. This is the investigation where presumably all the resources necessary are available to the state police and the state's attorney in Danbury. This is not, as your caller referred to, this is not the 30,000 gun deaths, which you would love to have that level of examination, but that of course is not possible.
I want to get to another story that's emerged this week about the Newtown shootings. In this, Mark, you've been covering a little bit. The National Shooting Sports Foundation, which of course is located right in Newtown, since the beginning they've been involved in this conversation. They are now essentially legally challenging the state and the way they decided to change gun laws. What are they saying?
It's interesting. They are attacking the lawfulness of the gun control measures that were passed in response to Newtown on the basis of the legislative process. You know, not the Second Amendment, not an allegation that Second Amendment rights have been infringed, but in the main, their argument is that the legislature did not abide by its own rules. In particular, this was an emergency certified bill, which has become a relatively common technique, and I think a far too common technique. And very briefly, what this means is it bypasses certain procedures. You don't have to have a public hearing. You can act on a bill immediately. Otherwise, bills have to be available to legislators for 2 full days for their review, which I would, offer an editorial note. And I think that is the greatest harm from the emergency certification process. Quite often you get these massive bills and legislators literally cannot read them. So it's an interesting approach. Given that the legislature gets to set its own rules, I have a hard time believing that a court is going to come in and invalidate a law on the basis of the legislative process. Maybe they will, but I will say they do have a point as to how the legislature operates, where people would see the word emergency and they think this is the legislation that was put together in response to the Myannis River Bridge collapse or something.
Well, they may have a point. Do you think they have a case, Tom Baden?
I'm not sure. I agree with Mark. The courts have given legislatures a lot of latitude when it comes to how they implement their own procedures. So if it's going to be challenged on procedural grounds, you never know. But I think that's a pretty steep hill to climb.
And the rule that they're accused of breaking, it was a statute. It wasn't a constitutional provision. So even there, I think a judge might look at it and say, well, they can change that law. Yeah. And the bottom line was, the legislation passed with a majority vote. It was signed into law by the governor. But I will say they do raise some legitimate, I think, criticisms about the legislative process.
And we've talked ad nauseum, and I think we probably won't continue this entire show, although we could, talking about the legislative process when it comes to whether or not it's the gun laws or Keno or the FOI restrictions on the photos after Sandy Hook, et cetera, et cetera. There are a number of different ways in which different groups of people on very different sides of the political spectrum have felt as though this legislature didn't give public comment enough time during this entire session.
Well, the courts have the courts did overturn the takeover of the Bridgeport school system on the grounds that the process the state did not follow its own rules. So you never want to issue a blanket statement that they're not going to do this. Anytime the people take a hard look at the way a legislature acts, it's not a very attractive process, as Mark said. And it's the old adage about sausage making. Two things in life you don't want to see, a law being made and sausage being made. And it generally does not accrue to the favorable perception of the legislature.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of sausage this session. I have to ask, Tom, because they're in your backyard, they're in Danbury, the National Shooting Sports Foundation actually making headlines a few times saying they're pulling out of support for the Coltsville Park in Hartford. Of course, right. this is the building that for years is going to be made into a national park site, the old Colt Armory. What's the impact of the NSSF in this entire debate right now? It seems as though they're raising their profile once again.
They are. They've been much more low-key than the NRA. You can drive by their building in Newtown and you wouldn't know they're there. It's a very attractive building with a very tiny sign that says NSSF. And they have existed largely to represent gun owners who are sportsmen. But they have been drawn into this more and more recently. They certainly don't have the political visibility of the NRA, and I don't think they are as willing to become mixed up in the hurly-burly of politics. But they've been elevated, whether they like it or not.
We may be coming back to some of the politics of all this in just a bit. We are going to take a break. Tom Baden is here. He's editor of the Danbury News-Times. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. We'll take your calls at 860-275-7266. There's a lot of news this week to get to on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's our Wednesday news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We're tackling a lot of news today. In studio with us is Mark Pazniokas. He's Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Tom Baden is here. He's editor of the Danbury News-Times. We'll be getting back to maybe some of the politics around the Sandy Hook shootings and the aftermath there. And there's a lot more to cover, including a big referendum in Springfield on casinos that we'll be talking about in a bit. But I want to turn attention to the DCF, the Department of Children and Families. Now, last August, DCF Commissioner Joette Katz joined us in studio to talk about her agency and how it traditionally operated.
Historically, it really had been mired in disaster. I mean, good things were going on. Something would go awry, amiss. There would be a disaster, a fatality. And politicians, quite frankly, and past governors would get on the Capitol steps and start railing about the agency. And the next thing you know, 500 children would get removed the next day.
That's Joette Katz speaking on Where We Live. Karen Florin is a court reporter for The Day of New London. She recently profiled Joette Katz, commissioner of the DCF. She joins us by phone. Karen, welcome to our show.
Good morning.
So how has the DCF been different under Joette Katz?
Well, she likes to get out there and say they are more family friendly now. They are not, quote, snatching and grabbing kids anymore, but working to place them back in the home with community providers helping out or with a relative.
So is this coming to fruition, though? She's talking about it. Is this what's actually happening on the ground?
It is happening on the ground. I think there are 40% less kids in foster care.
40% less kids in foster care. Some people would say that that's a very, very good thing. Of course, there are holes in the system as well. When we're reading this report that Mark Pazniokas' colleague Jackie Rabe Thomas wrote in the Connecticut Mirror, the federal court monitor who's been taking a look at DCF for almost as long as I've been in Connecticut here, says that of the 55 children in state custody whose cases were reviewed between January and March, the monitor's office found that DCF failed to provide 21 of these kids with necessary education, medical, and/or psychological care. There's a sense, Karen Florin, that things are changing at the DCF in some ways, but in other ways they haven't really changed at all. What's your sense?
My sense is that she's got a challenge in front of her, and she talks about the people who, the resistors. She said they call themselves the weebies. We be here before you got here. We be here when you're gone. So I think she's trying to win them over in a very firm way that she has.
Now, you're a court reporter there. You probably know a little bit about Joette Katz from her earlier days as a judge. How has she adapted to this new role? Because she was known to sometimes, I don't know, rub people the wrong way in her old job.
Well, I was interested in that. It was pretty interesting to hear her talk about moving away from the cerebral. She said, I know this is going to sound arrogant, but I could spend a whole day working on crafting a footnote on the court. Now she has to get out there and make decisions, and sort of be running on the ground. She said it was very important for her to start working with the media in a way she's never done before and to get out in front of things when something bad happens rather than let things fester. So I really think they're trying to work on the agency's reputation and their integrity.
Now, of course, she's faced some criticism subject this spring of a scathing newspaper column because she parked her BMW convertible in a state lot over the winter. How has she addressed with you some of these other issues, these things that have come up that, well, when you're the commissioner of an important department, you need to, I guess, watch out for?
Well, I think that she realizes how that could have appeared, and she got out in front of it again, apologized, and her attitude is, I'm just moving on. I have work to do here. That's not the important issue I need to focus on. She's really very motherly in a way. She calls them her kids. She's very good with the workers. I attended a statewide youth advisory board, and she let all of the workers and all of the kids there talk for what seemed like hours, and it was an after-hour session. I left after an hour and a half, and they were only on the first of three portions, so I can imagine it went on and on and on. But she was very warm with them. I think that she knows that she has been somebody who has been removed as a Supreme Court justice, and now she's sort of thrown herself back in in a big way. So I think she understands those risks that she's taking.
Last thing for you, Karen Florin, what happens with court oversight? Again, as we see this report come out, as long as the state is under this court oversight, this federal court oversight, because of the past sins of DCF, it seems as though we'll always get these reports that say we're not doing a good enough job. What's her plan for transitioning away from that?
She says if you just do the work, that will go away. She wants to bring Connecticut up to where other states have been. She says, shame on us. And if we just focus on doing the right thing for the kids, this will resolve itself.
Karen,
she does not teach to the test, she says.
Does not teach to the test. Karen Florin is a court reporter for The Day who recently profiled DCF Commissioner Joette Katz. You can read that at theday.com. And, of course, on our website as well, we have a few different instances where she's appeared on the program. Indeed, it is a little bit of change for the DCF, getting people out there talking about the work they do. So, Karen Florin, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. As we move on here on The Wheelhouse, talking with Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, I just have to ask, Mark, it seems as though a lot of these commissioners that Governor Malloy has put into place really do have these very broad agendas, lots of things they have to change, whether it's Joette Katz or Dan Esty. We're talking about high-profile people who seem to put an awful lot on their plate. What's the overall report card on these commissioners from you, that have so much that they're trying to do transformatively?
Well, I mean, Karen touched on it. It's anytime you're trying to change a massive state bureaucracy, there's always the question of whether you're there for one term, two terms, can you get it done? Now, in the case of some of these high-profile commissioners that Governor Malloy brought in, and quite frankly, Joette Katz was considered a huge get for him. She is it's first-rate intellect, very strong personality. I've known Joette Katz for a long time. Very blunt, not afraid to really rock the boat.
It doesn't suffer fools. Which
no,
is,
not at all.
Yeah.
Commissioner Esty, he's trying to do a lot of change rapidly. I think there's an expectation that when he's on leave from Yale. He did not give up his tenured position at Yale. I think there's a reasonable expectation that after the current 1 year sabbatical expires, we may see him leave for a bunch of reasons. In part, it would simplify his wife's life and her reelection. But then in DSS, the much maligned, deservedly so, Department of Social Services, Rod Bremby is a much quieter personality, but he is now at the point where he's been there a while. He has taken the measure of senior people, and he's making moves.
Well, and we may actually be talking with him again tomorrow. Just not so very long ago, we had him on the program. He was talking about setting up this new statewide phone system that they'd never had before. We were shocked, actually, to hear that the DSS didn't have one phone number you could call to get DSS services. They just put it online, got 11,000 phone calls that Connecticut Mirror reported in just the first day, so they've got a lot on their plate.
The DSS, historically, has been one of the most frustrating agencies to deal with, certainly as a reporter. When I was covering federal courts, there was a lawsuit about handicapped people trying to get durable medical equipment, and they couldn't get funding for it. Why? Because it wasn't on the approved list. Well, how do you get it on the list? Well, you can't. The list is the list. And I was having this conversation with a deputy commissioner, and I could feel my carotid artery start to throb, and I thought I'm going to have a stroke talking to this.
And you're just a reporter trying. You're not somebody actually trying to get these services, and that's the
well,
thing.
Well, I finally responded with some words that are not suitable on the air, and a federal judge, in a much nicer way, came to the same conclusion I had, which was this is ridiculous, and the federal court had to force them to change and say, hey, medical technology improves. Get with it. So that's what these commissioners are up against in some ways. There is an entrenched bureaucracy, and it is difficult to move.
Well, and here's actually Governor Malloy at a signing bill as he's signing this new energy policy we're going to be talking about some of these big changes that he's hoped to institute.
This collaboration between DECD and DEEP and other former silos in state government that we've actually been able to do away with so that we can work across borders and get things done is really quite remarkable.
There, Governor Malloy talking about a few agencies that, again, have been maligned over the years that he's trying to transform. He's doing this at the signing of this energy bill that had two real main components, Mark Pazniokas. One has to do with this very ambitious natural gas plan that Dan Esty has put forward. Another one having to do with hydropower becoming part of the portfolio of renewable energy. Well, let's take these one by one. I think, first of all, that this energy policy is a very big deal. It's getting interest from outside investors, people like a Texas company that wants to build new natural gas infrastructure. What does all this mean for Malloy?
The governor is taking two incredibly complicated bills, and he's boiling them down to a bumper sticker for 2014, which is we're going to give you energy that is cleaner, cheaper, more reliable. Everybody, follow along with me. Cleaner, cheaper, more reliable.
So I'll hear that again at some point.
You will. You will hear that ad nauseum through now until 2014. The governor is taking a gamble. He's trying to take these incredibly dense pieces of legislation that are changing markets. These bills, I would assert that at least half the legislature did not fully understand what they were voting on. And that's not as awful as it sounds. This is that complicated. They looked to certain.
It does sound pretty awful, but
it's. You know, when I said it just then, it really did sound
it
bad, didn't it?
It didn't sound good. But anyway, please
continue. But the 187 legislators cannot be experts on everything. And so they looked to certain legislative leaders, and there is an element of faith because, again, what they're doing, you are changing how markets work. you know, the shorthand is that the electric business has been deregulated in Connecticut. It has not. It has been to a certain degree, but the state still has a hand in this. There's a lot of concern about these two bills. One of them, this comprehensive energy strategy, it gives the Commissioner of Energy and Environmental Protection a fair amount of discretion to do things that he deems are in the interest of ratepayers and the people of Connecticut. And that got, you know, the environmental community a little nervous, because the other element of this is Governor Malloy has introduced sensitivity to price along with all the environmental goals. So the environmental community, they see a guy like Dan Esty, who made his bones writing about competitive factors, market factors.
Getting and how businesses green so they can make money.
Absolutely. And that's his big thing. He says competition and market forces should drive this, and that the old renewable portfolio standard, which was simply a set of goals that the state had to meet to use certain amounts of, you know, in the old days we called it alternative energy. You were basically talking wind, solar, geothermal, and there are other things. So he's saying there ought to be competition for this. The old model was, again, we're simplifying. The old model was there's a subsidy that people are willing to pay more for this type of energy. Esty and Malloy are saying, yeah, a little bit, but it's got to be driven by competition.
You know, the amazing thing about Dan Malloy is he is such an activist governor at a time of greatly restricted resources. This is a man who believes that government can accomplish great things, whether it's in healthcare or energy, economic investment. And he's come along at a time when, you know, the state is struggling to grow its economy, it's struggling to balance its budget, to restrain its workforce. And he thinks these things can be reformed, it can be changed. At the same time, he's colliding against certain economic realities.
But not just certain economic realities, but a core belief, I think, on his part that Mark touches on, that he believes that market economics work, that if indeed you put enough incentives in place for certain types of businesses, they will grow jobs on their own. Right. And that's a core belief, I think.
Right. I agree.
Well, and I think one other thing to get to quickly on this is that this is all going to play into the re-election campaign. I know that you've been taking a look off and on, Mark Pasniokas, about what Tom Foley's doing to maybe counteract all of this. He's got his own nonpartisan think tank that's running right now. I guess I'm wondering how Tom Foley is entering into this.
Tom Foley is an unannounced candidate, I think is the safe way to put it. For legal reasons, these guys can't declare too soon, because when they do that, then they have to account for literally every penny they spend on gas to drive around and visit people. But it's quite clear that he is running for governor. Within weeks, if not days, after his razor-thin loss in 2010 to Governor Malloy, he formed the Connecticut Policy Institute, which is a conservative think tank. Connecticut, by the way, already has one, the Yankee Institute. So there were some eyebrows raised. Why do we need another one? For the first 2 years of this institute, it really has put forward, you can see, a platform that Tom Foley can run on. Now, Mr. Foley took great exception to a story I wrote recently that sort of described this institute, at least over its first 2 years. I think it has reached a turning point now where it is trying to establish its own identity a little bit. But I described it as shadow boxing with the governor. In anticipation of the governor's first budget, the institute put out a paper a few days earlier warning about relying too heavily on income tax increases. After the governor's bipartisan jobs package, there was a critique of economic development approaches. Mainly, you know, Connecticut and Governor Malloy's administration has not fared very well in these papers, these white papers that the institute has.
I'm shocked. Shocked.
I understand. So, you know, Tom and I talked the other day, and again, he expressed hurt that, you know, I viewed this as too closely connected with his political ambitions. And I told him, I said, look, this institute, if it's to establish a separate identity, it's going to take time because people are, quite frankly, they're not going to believe it. And why should they? You see the guy who lost by a whisker for governor, who's running again, who's the founder of a think tank. Why wouldn't you view it that way?
So Tom Foley is running, although he hasn't officially said that he's running. We know that Larry Caffaro isn't going to run. We assume John McKinney's running. Somebody who's in your backyard, Tom Baden, Mark Bouton, the mayor of Danbury, he's run for governor before. Is he going to run for governor again?
He would like to. He has a little detail to get out of the way, which is his mayoral reelection. And it's generally very bad form to be looking past your next election. He has to campaign for that. He has to raise money. He has to do all the things that candidates do. He is blessed right now with not having any opponent. The Democrats are struggling to come up with someone to run against him. And whoever they do come up with is going to have huge disadvantages. Bouton's in a tricky spot because his best hope in some ways is to go in as a running mate. And he tried that last time. And judging from some of the comments that both Mr. Foley and Mr. Bouton have made, I don't think that partnership team is going to hook up again.
Wasn't the best team of all time.
No. Wait. Tom was so dry and so restrained about the prospect of another Foley-Bouton. But it ain't going to happen. They don't like each other.
No.
But, you know, Bouton has been – Mark Bouton's he's fun to cover.
Yeah, Mark chuckles when that subject is brought up. But is Bouton strong enough to take on Foley? He doesn't have the same kind of financial resources. He'd have a compressed calendar to raise money. He has been going around the state. He'll show up at various town committee meetings. He's doing all the things he should do. He can run on the Danbury economy, which is probably – one of the, if not the healthiest, economies in the state. So, you know, he's doing what he has to do. It would be an uphill fight.
Yeah, and you can always follow him on Twitter if you don't know enough about what Mark Bouton is doing on a day-to-day basis. It's hashtag Big Papa. Yeah, that's right. We're talking today with Tom Baden, he's editor of the Danbury News-Times, and Mark Pasniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. CTN is here as well. It's The Wheelhouse. It's our Wednesday weekly news roundtable. When we come back, there's a big vote coming up on Tuesday in Springfield about the possibility of a new casino there. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's The Wheelhouse, our Wednesday weekly news roundtable. We've been covering a lot today, but we want to get to a story that's just north of our border for all of our listeners in Springfield, Massachusetts, listening to WAIC. There's a very big vote coming up on Tuesday, and this vote has implications not just in Massachusetts, but also here in Connecticut, because it has to do with casino gambling. Paul Tuthill covers this issue and many others for us from WAMC. He's the Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief. Paul, welcome back to the show.
John, thank you. Good to be here.
So, first of all, what exactly is going down on Tuesday in Springfield? What are you all voting on?
Well, what they're voting on is a referendum on the $800 million casino development project proposed by MGM Resorts International. Now, specifically, MGM and the city of Springfield, the mayor and his casino consultants, negotiated what is known as a host community agreement. This basically spells out the terms of this development, what the casino is going to do for the city of Springfield in terms of jobs, cash payments, other amenities that the casino developers promised to build. And on Tuesday, the final step in this process, in this ratification process, the agreement was signed by the mayor, and it was endorsed by the city council in a unanimous vote back in May. And now the final step in this process is a citywide referendum, which will take place on Tuesday, July 16th. If the voters give thumbs up, that gives MGM Resorts International the green light to go to the Massachusetts Gaming Commission and ask for a casino license, and only one casino license is authorized in Western Massachusetts. The local voter referendum, though, by state law, is a prerequisite. If the referendum fails, then that stops the project dead in its tracks. So it's a very, very high-stakes vote that's coming up here on Tuesday.
But, of course, just because this vote, let's say, may give thumbs up to this plan, that doesn't mean that we're going to see this particular casino built in Springfield, because there is only going to be one license given for the western part of the state. Where's the other competition?
Well, the competition comes from two other fairly large casino operators. Mohegan Sun, which we know you're familiar with down in Connecticut, has proposed a project project in Palmer, Massachusetts, which is a somewhat rural community, just about 10 miles to the east of Springfield. In fact, Mohegan Sun has been cultivating that project in Palmer for several years now. They've had a presence in that community. Just recently, last week, they unveiled a dramatic new artist renderings for a revamped $1 billion project. And they've loaded this casino up with several amenities, including an indoor and outdoor water park and a second hotel and retail and restaurant projects that they want to go along with the resort casino development. The other competitor in Western Massachusetts is Hard Rock International, which is proposing to build on a property that is currently part of the Big E, which I know folks in Connecticut are probably familiar with, the Eastern States Exposition, the big regional agricultural themed fair, which takes place every fall. Hard Rock International is in the process of trying to negotiate a final agreement with officials in the city of West Springfield. There are reports that agreement might be finalized as soon as today. Hard Rock is hoping to bring that to a vote in West Springfield in early September before the Big E gets underway, actually. And also in Palmer, Mohegan Sun officials are hoping to wrap up negotiations with town officials there by next week so that they can also get a voter referendum on the ballot in Palmer sometime in September.
So the next step in all this is on Tuesday, Springfield voters give a thumbs up or a thumbs down to this MGM plan to see whether or not they can get a casino there. We'll be checking back in, of course, with Paul Tuthill, who covers the gambling expansion in Massachusetts for us out of WAMC. He's the Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief there. Thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Anytime, John.
Quickly, Mark Pazniokas, I just want to ask, Connecticut's feeling on this expansion in Massachusetts, it's coming fast and furious. Of course, we're talking about Keno here. It's an entirely different thing. Are people at the Capitol worried about a casino right across the border in Springfield?
Absolutely. And when Connecticut got its two tribal casinos, which quickly became two of the largest casinos in the world, it was this incredible pot of gold. And the slot revenues you've seen, they peaked, I think, 2 years ago. Some of it has to do with the recession, but a lot of it has to do with competition. While we're looking at Massachusetts, which I believe isn't as much of the immediate threat as New York is, because New York already has video casinos, as it were, at the Yonkers Raceway, at Aqueduct, and They're intercepting a lot of folks who used to come up 95 to the Mohegan and Foxwoods. The Massachusetts process that he just laid out is a pretty complicated process. And you think about it, in the case of Palmer, Massachusetts, you have these small towns that get by referendum to make a huge decision for the region. So it's a very, it's a multi-layered process. Foxborough, the Kraft was involved with somebody who wanted to put a casino there. The town of Foxborough voted it down. So, 30,000 people can say no to a casino expansion. So it may take longer than people think in Massachusetts for some pieces of this. But Rhode Island also has expanded, video slots and video gaming.
Now, before we run out of time, there's one more story we wanted to get to. Now, Mark was telling us he just went to go see Paul McCartney at Fenway Park. Michelle Dupre went to go see another legend in concert, and her experience led to a lawsuit against the Excel Center in Hartford. Michelle Dupre joins us. She's director of New Haven's Department of Services for Persons with Disabilities. Michelle, welcome to the program. So what happened when you went to go see the boss?
Well, I went with a friend, and we were seated in the wheelchair seating. And as you would expect, people were excited to see Bruce Springsteen. And the entire concert, 3+ hours, the people were standing. And so anybody seated in the wheelchair seating that was actually in a wheelchair couldn't see the performance. And I knew this was wrong, that people with disabilities deserved a better opportunity to enjoy the performance.
Is this something that comes up often? Is this the sort of suit that is filed against performance venues for this very same reason in the past, Michelle?
There have been several suits around the country similar. There recently was one in Memphis, and I know some other arenas have had difficulty with this, what's called line of sight problem.
So now, how did you try to solve this problem before filing the lawsuit? Is there some other way that you can talk to the Excel Center about this?
Well, I talked to staff on hand and didn't get satisfactory answers. I then went to the Attorney General's office because the state of Connecticut is a heavy user of the facility, plus the Connecticut Development Authority was operating it at the time. So I tried to solve it that way. It didn't quite work out. So I ended up bringing in the Department of Justice.
So what do you think that performance venues like the Excel Center can and should be doing? Because as we've often said, this facility is not the most modern. There are a lot of amenities that newer hockey arenas or concert venues have, both for disabled people and others, that a place like the Excel Center that's 30-some years old doesn't have. I mean, what do you think that they can do to make it better for people with disabilities?
Well, for starts, they can recognize that a large portion of our population has disabilities. And so it's to their benefit to make money to be accessible. But it doesn't matter the age of the facility. There are things they can do. They can make bathrooms accessible. I was at Fenway Park a couple weeks ago. They've done a beautiful job making the line of sight available for wheelchair users. So it is feasible. It takes work, it takes planning, and it takes money.
And Mark Pasiokas, if Fenway Park, which was built in 1912, I believe, can do it, it seems as though other facilities probably can as well.
Yeah, at Fenway, there's some seating that's up higher. And if somebody stands in front of you, the way people do at concerts, I mean, it is a challenge for a concert as opposed to a hockey game, a basketball game, or a baseball game. There was a 6 foot, 6 inch man in front of me last night, you know, so of course I could stand, so it wasn't an issue. But if I wanted to sit, I wasn't seeing much of Paul McCartney.
So, Michelle Dupre, before I let you go, well, what happens next here?
Well, a lot of the changes have been made. I hope that this is a starting point for the operators of the Excel Center, that they'll go above and beyond what's required in the agreement, and hopefully more people with disabilities will enjoy going to events at the Excel Center.
You were able to hear the show. Had you ever seen Springsteen before in concert?
That was my first Springsteen concert. I've seen him twice since.
Oh, so what did you think? How was the concert? Just being able to hear it, I suppose.
Well, it was amazing being able to hear it, and I've since tried some other venues and been able to see the performance as well, and it was great.
What's the best venue you've been to for as far as line of sight?
Actually, in Connecticut, I would say Mohican Sun has been the best one I've been to, which is ironic because there's an argument that they're not covered by the accessibility laws.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Michelle, we will have to check back in with you. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing the story. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michelle Dupre is director of New Haven's Department of Services for Persons with Disabilities. I want to thank her. I also want to thank Mark Pasiokas, who's Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks, Mark, so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Tom Baden. He's editor of the Danbury News-Times. Thank you, Tom.
My pleasure.
Thanks to CTN for being here as well. This is The Wheelhouse on WNPR's Where We Live. It's produced by Tucker Ives. With Katie Solarski, the senior producer, we'll leave you with the boss.